So hi everybody and welcome along to this class. So we begin as we normally do. We'll start off with a meditation where we take refuge and generate the mind of enlightenment. So a few more prayers then the class will begin. And there's sections in the class where you can actually ask questions and for us to meditate. And you just get comfortable in your seat. This basically means you want to have your back straight. If possible, have your feet flat on the cushion or on the floor just for the meditation. It's just to get some sort of stability. So once you do feel comfortable, just let your body breathe itself. Because this, when you sleep, when you're walking around the city or when you're driving a car, your body will breathe itself. So just let that take place there. And as your body breathes itself, become aware of what that feels like and where the movements are taking place. And as you exhale, imagine all tensions, tightnesses leave the body. The body feels quite relaxed and comfortable in its seat. And while the body breathes itself and continues to relax, I'd like you to imagine that in the space above you appears Buddha Shakyamuni sitting on a golden throne. He is surrounded by many other enlightened beings. While you yourself are surrounded by all sentient beings, beings of a consciousness. And these include your parents, your family, friends, enemies, and strangers. And what we have in common with all sentient beings is the wish to be happy and the wish to be free from suffering. And these two wishes have not yet been met because we constantly work against these wishes. This is just unfortunate. But having understood that we are the creators of our own happiness and the creators of our own suffering, we need a reliable method to put an end to that suffering we experience and to need a method to create all the good qualities. Now, the Buddha and his teachings and his community supply us with the means to accomplish these two wishes of ours. So think that you wish to develop your wisdom and your compassion and every other ability you have to put an end to your own suffering and to put an end to the causes that produce that suffering. And because there's no difference between ourselves and others, decide to also help others do the same. And then to articulate that, join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now, in response to this articulated wish of ours, think that lights and nectars stream from the heart of the Buddha and all the other enlightened beings surrounding it. These lights and nectars pour down through space and wash over you and over all the people surrounding it. And everything that hinders your spiritual path is removed. good qualities are now accessible. And you now recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of compassion, love, joy, and equanimity. And you decide to establish these for yourself and in the minds of all sentient beings. And so you say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the vice of attachment and friends, hatred for enemies. In response to this wish of ours that's been articulated, lights and nectars stream down from the heart of each enlightened being. They wash over you and over everyone else around you. And these four boundless and immeasurable thoughts are revealed. Then recollected in the field of merit is faith and devotion. Prepare yourself to now purify the mind and accumulate and increase merit. So again, with the enlightened beings of body, join me in saying, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma to living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. Now, to prevent ourselves clinging to the merit and the result of purification, imagine that your body, speech, mind, all of your merits, in fact, everything that you normally perceive through your senses is utterly transformed and reappears as an enlightened land, an enlightened place, where you give teachings to others in the future. And you say, so, now this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun, and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and object. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. So I've released this mandala. The Buddha has accepted it with delight and he smiles at us. And we look up into his eyes and meet his gaze. And under the gaze of the Buddha, we feel accepted and at ease. Then an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart, moves through space and comes to the bottom of the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. And now the emanation descends down to the level of your heart. Whereby this body of light begins to expand, filling your body and mind with lights and nectars. And these nectars of light now pour out through the pores of your own skin and fill the 10 directions of space. Thereby establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. And then throughout the vastness of space, you hear the mantra of the Buddha resounding, and you join in, saying this for three times, this mantra. Tayata Om Rim Mahamrunaya Saha. Tayata Mahamrunaya Saha. Some of your breath and recite a few more times. And I think that the complete path to enlightenment has been established upon your own mental continuum and the mind stream of every other living being. And we are breathing in through your nostrils, exhaling. And just think that you've accomplished the two purposes, your own welfare and the welfare of others. Okay, so we're up to, so we're up to class four on this topic, and this is actually, this really is sort of first class, we're actually sort of begin the whole process of using these two meditation manuals that we've been talking about. So today we're going to have a look again at how to practice what we call everyday Dharma. And there again we'll look at the purification of speech, so this will come at the very end of the lesson. And in the meantime, we'll be talking about the six preliminaries before we actually engage in the practice. Now, the material I've used to help present these classes is basically these books here. And so mainly this text called Shakyamuni Buddha, and the very first one, The Method to Transform a Suffering Life into Happiness. As you know, when you begin a practice of Dharma, the most important thing is the reason for doing it. Motivation is of supreme importance. It's also helpful to remember that motivation is an integral part of what we call karmic cause and effect. So when we decide to act, that is right there, the impetus for a karma. And I've been using this very short verse to show one of the ways you can create a motivation. So here we have Lama Zopa's a quote from him on this book, Transforming Problems into Happiness. And you can see here it says, the purpose of having this precious human body is not simply to achieve happiness for myself, but to eliminate the suffering of all other beings and bring them happiness. And this is the purpose of my life. And as you know, Lama Zopa, which is quite, I think, quite famous for many of his motivations. Some of them are very long and very detailed. This one, of course, is very, very short. But I like it to just get straight to the point. You know, okay, this is why I'm doing practices. It's not just for me, it's for everyone else as well. It's not just about the happiness of this life, it has to go from this life to future lives all the way up to enlightenment. That's why I'm practicing. This does not come natural to you, so sometimes it'll take a bit of time to work up to it. So we begin with transforming ordinary actions into Dharma. So the way I've tried to structure this is, like I've tried to imagine, like, you know, we've gone to sleep, we've woken up in the morning, and our eyes may open, and then we're sort of going to get out of bed, we'll go to the bathroom, we'll do a few things, and then we actually begin our practice. But practice can actually begin like as soon as you open your eyes. You don't even have to get out of bed. But straight away, you can start transforming the simple action of waking up, getting out of bed, walking on the floor, going to the toilet, washing your face, and getting dressed. All of these simple activities can all become Dharma. So I'll start off with this one because I've done a few others beforehand, for those of you new, with getting dressed. So we've gone to the bathroom, so we're going to dress ourselves. We'll probably have a cup of tea and then we'll engage in our practice. So when you get dressed and you put clothing on, what you can simply say to yourself is, may all beings be adorned with the armor of patience. So as you can see, like clothing, you think of it like in the old days, they used to put on armor, didn't they? They put the armor on and it got white. So if somebody comes with a big stick or a sword or something to poke at it, it won't kill them. It just hits the armor and it'll be deflected. So when we put on our ordinary clothing, it's like, okay, I'm going to go out into the world dressed. And it's not going to be easy. people are going to say unkind things to me. I'm going to see things I don't particularly like. I'm going to hear words I really don't want to hear. I'm going to see things I really don't want to see either. But I'm going to be patient with it. I'm not going to let anger arise. So we put on our clothes and we say, well, I'm going out into the world. It's not an easy world to be in. I could get upset. But I'm not going to. I'm going to be patient. We try and look, this is, I put on clothing to protect the body. I put on the mind of patience to protect myself from harm. Then, if we've got our clothes on, we wandered off to the kitchen, we would have made ourselves a cup of tea. And so when we do this in the morning, I mean, probably we've all had breakfast in the morning, what do you normally think? We all think something, don't we? We have breakfast, what is it? Well, you're laughing, tell me. Sorry, what was it?
Coffee.
Coffee, that's right, coffee. Who's it for? Me. That's right, right? So everything on that plate, is it's all about me. And why am I going to eat it? Just, that's right, to sustain ourselves from work, from breakfast throughout the day, aren't we? So it's primarily about self. Right? But our motivation is, you know, we said, actually, it's not just about me, it's for everyone else too. So what can I sort of say or think about this cup of tea or toast I'm going to eat? So here is one way you can do it. When you come to drink your tea, instead of offering it to yourself as you are like this, you can imagine you have your teacher or the Buddha at your heart. And when you drink the tea, it's going to go down. It goes. And you think, well, it's not going to be ordinary tea, but now it's going to be transformed into wisdom nectar. And I'm going to offer this wisdom back to my teacher. So we say things like this. To the Supreme Teacher, the Precious Buddha. To the Supreme Refuge, the Precious Dharma. To the Supreme Guides, the Precious Sangha. To all the objects of refuge, I make this offering. And that's in my grasp, we just go ourselves, it's not, you know, we give it away. And we're giving it to all these holy beings or the texts and so forth. Because, like I said before, we want to develop our wisdom, compassion, and our abilities. We realize that selfishness will hinder that. So we want to become more humble and more generous. So we say something like this, and then we imagine. We're offering it to either your teacher, imagine it's a Buddha at your heart, or another simple way of doing this is, so you know, our body is made up of all these what we call non-bodily elements. And so within the body, there's a lot of living beings. And they're very useful for us, like they keep us alive, right? So we still say, well, all these living beings that make up my body, here, have a feed, have a drink. I mean, you're doing so much good for me, so thank you very much. So again, we offer. Again, this is primarily about becoming more generous and sort of working against our natural inclination to be stingy with what we've got. And so we turn, like I said, these two simple activities before we actually begin sitting down to do practice and everything, into the path through motivation. Now then, right, so now we're going to actually imagine we've had something to drink it up, now we're going to go and sit down and do our practice. And so we're going to talk about now is like preparing to have a successful practice. And this preparation is made up of six stages. And so we're going through three of them today. So the first thing we need to do is clean the room and the altar. So wherever you have a place for meditating, you want to go there and like often you can have a little brush or vacuum cleaner or something. But you want to clear your floor space and you set up your cushion and you'll have a look at your altar and look, is there any dust on it? And they say, even if there's no dust, just pick it up and lightly brush and so forth. So it's like getting everything ready. So I'm just going to say a few words about each of these. We'll go into them more in more detail later. So we clean the room and the altar. Then we make the offerings. So here, as you can see, before I came up, the seat was all prepared. This has all been cleaned, and all the offerings are already set up. So if you're at home and you have your seat there, and you go, oh, I've got it, maybe put some water bowl offerings, or a candle, or a piece of fruit, or make an offering on this altar. Then we sit down, take our seat. So there's a way of sitting correctly. We take refuge and generate the mind of enlightenment. So look, we've done all that this morning. All of us have done that. Just today we'll talk about more in detail. Those three there, this is mainly what we're talking about. And then we have what we call the merit field. So this, we've already done that too this morning. And we do this merit field, there's a number of different practices within it. Seven limbs and the mandala. And finally, there's this last thing we do, we sort of request some inspiration. Now, you might look at this and say, so each of these functions, each of these six functional things, has a purpose that's beyond just like getting up there and cleaning the floor and putting something on the altar. Each one's meant to have an effect on the mind. So this next one is to show you what each one of these effects is meant to be. So the first one is to actually purify the mind. It looks like we're cleaning the room, and we are, but the major thing is like to clean the mind, get the mind ready for what we're about to do. Then the second is to cultivate abundance. Now, as I said before, we make offerings, it's to go against stinginess. And this is saying, look, we've got everything we need right now. You don't need it. You see, everything's fine with you. You are complete. You have everything here to attain your goal. So you can at least put up a banana on the altar. You can put some water there, you know. You can offer because you've got everything. It's not a problem for you. And the third one, when we take the seat, is to like align our bodily and mental energy and the motivation together. And then the next one was what the merit field. Yeah, so this is often you can go through life and feel quite alone. We should say that I am lonely. I felt like I'm, you know, we're not really in the right within everyone, are we? We sort of, you could feel that way, at least on sort of on the outer, a little different than everybody else. But this thing is saying that you're not alone. Like the enlightened beings, we have always been with you, and we will always be with you. All you have to do is recognize it. So when you do your practice, think that we as enlightened beings are going to support you in the practice. The practices with the merit field, the seven limbs. Here we just sort of try to purify the mind as much as possible and accumulate as much merit as possible. So we also recited the little verse that goes with that when you came in. And finally, we seek what they call inspiration. So you finally say some things like, well, this is what I would like to do, this is what I want to get rid of, help me do it. They show that if you use an agricultural analogy, they say that attempting to meditate without these preliminaries is like trying to plant a crop on frozen and stone-covered ground. No matter how good the seed is, or no matter how much you want to plant, get a crop, it's not going to happen because of the nature of the ground. You haven't prepared the ground to grow that crop. But here, like when we got what we, this is what we're doing. Right? We're preparing ourselves to have a successful outcome. Now, I tell you, as a, I noticed about myself, and I'm going to assume other people are a little bit like me, where this sort of thing seems unnecessary, or like too much. I just want to meditate, right? I just want to sit down and meditate. Thank you. That's good. If you're trying to meditate, and that might be fine if it were a non-Buddhist meditation. But if you're engaging in Buddhist meditations, you're going to need a bit of assistance here. And so these ways are ways of just trying to assist ourselves and have a successful outcome. So before I go, I'll just ask, do you guys have any questions about what I've said so far? We're going to go next into this, the first one called Purifying the Mind, and then we'll work our way down to number three here. We'll have a meditation and so forth, and you guys ask me questions if you want to. So any questions just for just now before we go into the details? So the major thing, I guess, to take away from so far is we know that there are six preliminary practices here.
So can you expand on seeking inspiration?
Yep. Let me see. Well, seeking inspiration is the drink number six. Yes, but not today. Well, that'll be next week, probably. But yeah, sure. Okay, so let's begin with this first one called Purifying the Mind. It's just mean, you know, you do that by like doing something else, which is just like cleaning the room or cleaning your space. Let's see, what did I say here about it? In essence, you're cleaning the external environment, but you're really cleansing the mind to make it more receptive to what might arise in the meditation. There's a famous story about this. About a man who was very, very, what they call dull. He was, and I've had an experience of his dullness. So this fellow was so dull. And if they gave a sentence with, I'd say, three words in it, he'd say the first one. By the time he got to the second, he'd have forgotten the first. And when he got to the third, the second and first had both forgotten. So he couldn't retain anything, yet he had a very intelligent brother. So his brother was trying, and they were both monks. So the intelligent brother thought, I'll try and help my younger brother. He found he wasn't able to. And primarily this has to do with sort of karmic consequences that relate back to these two boys, how they were born and a lot of other stuff. But this young fellow, he wants to be a good monk, and there's this dullness stopping him. So the Buddha hears about this and comes along and says, okay, look, stop trying to memorize things and learn all the stuff. What I want you to do is just clean the sandals of all the monks. When they come in, they take their shoes off. I want you to clean them and stack them nicely. When the monks come back out, they'll put their clean sandals. Yep, okay, I can do that. So he does that. And so he's able to be that successful. Then the Buddha says, that, very good. Now I want you to go inside the Gompa, inside the meditation hall, and just go around and just sweep the dirt and the dust out so when the monks come to meditate, it's a nice clean place. He says, yeah, I can do that. Okay, but this time, this is when you clean, I want you to say, dirt out, dust out. And do the four words, dirt out. And so this is what he would do. That was what he did. And this went on for quite a long time. And the Buddha just left it with it. But then one day this fellow thinks, what is the dirt? What is the dust that I'm saying out? And what he realizes is that what really needs to be, what the dirt is the natural afflictions that we have, like hatred, lust, fear, great doubt, these sort of things. This is the dirt. And then the dust is like the causes or even the cognitive obscurations. So there's two types of problems facing this fellow. Afflictions, afflictive obscurations, and cognitive obscurations. And so I've got to get, and listen, if we want to become a Buddha, we have, that's what we have to remove from our mind stream. And he realizes, oh, this is what this means. And he takes us to the Buddha and is very happy. He said, this is great, we've made some progress. He said, now, I'm going to let all the nuns know that you're going to teach them. So all the nuns go, we're not going to sell that fellow, he's stupid. And So that was, a version of having a monk who everyone knows is really dull give a teaching to us. So they decide to make it, have a little bit of fun at his expense. They make it very hard for him to sort of actually, sort of, just like me, I'm sitting on the seat here. When this monk was to give a teaching, he has to sort of sit on the seat too. But the nuns built it really high up, so he couldn't get up there. Like this guy, I just step on. He's like that. But even when they come up to get the teaching, he's sitting there. And they can't figure out, like, how the heck did he get up there when we made it near impossible? But he doesn't say anything about it, he's sitting waiting. Everybody comes to take the teaching. He gives us an amazing, amazing teaching on ethics that goes on a couple of days. And everybody's like, oh my goodness, man, they had no idea as far as realizing intelligence and everything like that. But this, like I said, this has all come away from this idea of the simple cleaning and just saying these two words, four words, sorry, dust out, dirt out. So the Sangha have been doing this ever since. So when they go out to do the cleaning, this is what they say, because they go, wow, this guy had such a great effect by saying this. Perhaps we might have the same effect. So we can take the same idea when we go out and do our dusting. We say, dirt out, dust out. It's just as the way I need to get rid of the afflictive and cognitive obscuration. I need to get rid of everything that hinders my mind from knowing reality and acting accordingly. That's the basic story behind this, and this is the sort of approach. In fact, it's been the case that many of the Dalai Lamas, the past Dalai Lamas, even though they're very old, they could barely walk, they still do this. They still, the 13th Dalai Lama, for instance, his holiness was saying he'd always clean his room himself. You don't get anyone else to do it. They'd always be going dirt out, dust out, making it as clean as possible. So they have cleaned the room, so now we've got to look at the altar. And so we clean this room and the altar, now we've got to prepare the altar. Now most times the altar's already prepared. You just sort of prepare it once like this, right? We didn't go up there and do it all over again. It's already sitting in place. But what it means is that you've got to go there and sort of pick up each thing and like clean it a bit. And then clean the surface and then put it all back up again. You prepare for practice. And so here we're going to show you like how do you prepare the altar? Where, what goes where? So here's a big altar behind me. You can see right in the middle is the Buddha. And that's what you do. Place the Buddha goes in the middle. If you're going to have anything on that altar, and sometimes altars can be quite elaborate, but if you're going to make it really simple, that's enough. The Buddha is enough. Everything that's contained in the Buddha, that's enough. However, being the people we often do a bit more. So we put a few more things up there. And the things we can put up there are the text and a picture of Ernest and a stupa. So when we look at the Buddha, he's got that right arm down. So on that side, where the arm is down, that's where the text goes. And on the other side is the stupa. And in front of them are all the offerings. So you can see here, there's a lot of water bowls, there's lights and so forth. These are all offerings to the So up in front of every enlightened or representation of an enlightened being is an offering of some sort. And finally, which this is quite shocking for some Buddhists, you put a picture of your teacher above the Buddha. So this is fine in the Tibetan tradition of Mahayana Buddhism. But if you were from the Pali tradition, they'd be shaking their head like this, and no, no, no. In fact, one time, monks from the Pali tradition came here and they saw that His Holiness up there, straight away questions, why is that up there? Yeah. So within different traditions, different ways of setting up the altar. Now you might ask, is it really necessary to set up an altar? And the answer is no. It's very useful for beginners because you have something to focus upon. And it's very, very useful for high Shaiva Tantra practitioners. Because you do need to, you have to make a lot of offerings as a tantric. I don't know if anybody knows the story of Milarepa. You know, he had the only thing he had in his cave was a little bowl he could eat out of and drink out of. That was it. He was naked. He had no clothing. His sister got so embarrassed about it that she actually went out and made him a cloth. And that's where he got the name Repa, Milarepa. The Repa's for the cotton clan. She made him a cotton cloth. And you know, he was wondering, what's the problem with me being naked? No problem having no clothes and so forth. So the only thing he had was this begging bowl, and he used to drink his water out of it, and he would put nettles in there to eat. Right? So like I say, you walk in the cave, there is no altar. And if you think about it, you know, like, in a way, you yourself are the altar. You know, we offer our body, speech, and mind, aren't we, into this path to attain enlightenment. So we're offering up everything we're doing to become a enlightened person. None of the offerings, of course, are for the Buddha's benefit. But every offering we put up, the Buddha doesn't need our offerings. We put it up there because it benefits us. It's like in what way? You say, well, at least I can stop being stingy for a little bit. You know, I could always go out there and get some water. What's the problem with water? And so forth. And of course, there's a lot of material about these offerings, how you make them, what they mean, and so forth. So, as you can see up here, are many water bowl offerings. And when Lama Atisha came to Tibet, he looked at Tibet and said, offer water. The water here is so fantastic in Tibet compared to India. It doesn't cost you anything. It's very simple. We can all do it. So he suggested to the Tibetan people, offer water. You can see there's 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 bowls, 7 glasses here. And what we're trying to do here is there's a verse that says, cool and delicious, light and soft, limpid water, free from all impurities. When drunk, it does not harm the stomach, into the throat, it does no injury. And so we offer it as a means for us to have pure morality, a gentle and peaceful mind, a clear mind, and to be free from illness. There's also instructions about how you put them up there. So you want to sort of bring them up to a certain level about even, and the gaps between each glass or cup need to be of a certain measurement. But all this is just to help us be disciplined about what we're doing and mindful and completely aware. And being generous with the offerings. Like I said, to oppose stinginess, to overcome greed, and because we're making an offering, right? So this is the cause for us to have the resources we need in other lives. So, you know, so many of us, especially in Australia, in the West, I think we have pretty good lives. We have plenty of clothing we can get access to. We've got vehicles, electricity, a lot of great stuff that can really support us in our practice. So these are what we call the resources. And so if you want them, you have to put in place the cause for having them. The cause for having the resources is for us to give, to be generous. If we give, we get. That's the idea. Cause, effect. Giving is a result of wealth. Giving is a cause for wealth. Seems quite strange, doesn't it? Because in this life, we don't want to give anything away to become wealthy. You want to get more and more, which is, you know, a whole long time. But here it's a bit different. And of course, we're doing this through common enlightenment. So one time, I remember we were having a commentary for one of the geshes, and he asked us, he said, look, he said, when you look at the sadhana, he said, there are so many offering practices in it. Like, yeah, you do a little bit, then it's like, now you've got to make all these offerings again. Then you do a little bit more, now it's offering time again. And it's, you know, if you don't know what's going on, like, it's a bit boring. To me, it's just like, oh, man, again, you know. But you can see how my mind is working like that. It's a little stingy and lazy, isn't it? When you say things like that, right? Oh, do this again. So, guestless sisters, why are we doing this so often? You know, and as answers, because we need resources. We need to have the ability to actually practice the Dharma. That depends. We need certain things to help us. And so by offering water and imagining, sometimes we can make straight off from water, or other times we can imagine the water being something else. It's actually sort of transforming the mind. Now, when we make the offering, it should be done with what they call the three purities. So, motivation. Again, this is the most important thing you'll ever do is on a Dharma practice, like why are you making the offerings? That they want to become enlightened. And enlightenment will depend upon having the resources. That's what we'll make. Now, the field. This, the field means the objects that you're making it to. So you need to make, so the offering point is made to the Buddha and all the enlightened beings. This is what we call the field of enlightened beings. And then thirdly is the material that you're giving. So they say here, this means it's to be purer. So this is what one meaning you can take from it. Just sometimes it might be that you head off to the Dharma Center to do a puja, like tonight, isn't it? It's one on tonight. Yeah. So at this puja, it's an offering service, right? So you bring along gifts, flowers, food, something, money, whatever you can afford. So it's happened sometimes that you're on your way and you suddenly realize, oh my gosh, I didn't bring any offerings. So imagine you're walking down the road here, you're coming up, I haven't got anything to offer. But you see some nice flowers growing in the garden and or the tree, right? And so you reach up and you just grab those, right? And now you've brought some flowers along. They said, no. Those flowers, were they given to you? Yeah, no, I took them. When you take things that aren't given to you, that's called stealing. So now you're going to offer these enlightened beings things you stole. So no, don't do that. And there's a few other little things like that one I read about these offerings. And when you put them up, they should be tried to arrange as beautifully as possible. In fact, Lama Yeshe used to say what he would do. You go out shopping. So he'd come home and bring out the shop and he'd just put it all on the altar. He'd offer it all to the Buddhas and then he'd just take out what he needed for himself. Excuse me, Buddha. So he seems to cook up his meal and all sort of stuff, right? Okay, so which leads us now to this first part of what I always call like what's interesting. So this is where you guys get a chance to ask me anything you like, or if you have any doubts about anything, just say it. I should also say, because I see a couple of new faces here, oftentimes with this material, it comes so much at you, you can't even come up with a question. It takes a bit of time for all to settle down, and then you go, oh, I wonder about that, I wonder about this.
I've got a little question, sure. I'm fairly new. When you were showing where everything goes on the altar, what was the pointy thing on the right-hand side?
Stupa. So that's a representation of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind. And the Oh, that's one heck of a teaching right there. We've got books like that thick just on the stupa and its meanings, and I've got many different types of stupas to these. Yeah, this one's cool. Yes.
So recently we had to move house, and the last thing that I dissolved in our house was my altar. And I noticed when I set up at our new place, it didn't have the same energy because I was so used to sitting in my room. As soon as I sat there, my mind went straight into, oh, this is meditation time, because it's a strong habit that had been built up, which was fine. I was like, oh, I just have to build that up in the new place. But it was just an interesting to see, like, you know, even though sometimes you think, oh, it's so superficial, making water bowl offerings and doing all that, but that trains your mind into get ready to do your meditation.
Yes. Yes, George.
Should we
also get a certain height? Yes, okay, yeah. So the altar, you want it to be like higher than your knees. They often say to you, like, if it's possible, set your meditation place, like you have a particular place for it. Now, a lot of people like have it in their bedroom or their even sitting room. So this is a little tricky because if you have it in your, for instance, in your sitting room or in a place which is quite public, when you have guests over or friends over who may not be doing what you're doing, but they could look at that and then have particular thoughts that are not very good about you and your practice or the Dharma or what you're trying to do. That's not a good thing to happen, is it? Here we have this idea that you can get rid of all your negative emotions. And now somebody comes in and says, oh, look at that. Now, why would you want to have somebody walk away like that? It means you're stuck, if that's your attitude. But you don't mind if you're stuck. So this will go completely against the vow. This thing of why am I practicing? For the benefit of all beings. Well, gosh, I just brought in a guest. Did it benefit them? You go, no. You go, well, then this doesn't benefit them. So maybe I need to hide the altar in some way, shield it. Yeah? But then if others come over and they're quite open to what I'm doing and so forth, of course I can take the shield down and it's fine. But just be aware of that sort of thing. Right? You do not want to disturb the minds of other people about the religion or practices you're engaged in.
Funny story, I saw it before, but kind of on that note, I have mantras above doorways in our old house, and I have family members who are not Buddhists come and help me move. And after a while, some of the boys said to me, what's all these things stuck above the doors? And I said, well, I'm Buddhist, so we have these mantras, and we believe that when you walk under them, it purifies your negative karma. And they're like, oh, wow, that's fantastic. We've been walking under these doors all day long.
Yeah.
But it was in such a way that it wasn't out there, and they were the ones who asked for it, the information. So,
yeah, these things are meant to sort of enlighten the mind, lift it up, not drag it down and then make people feel uncomfortable and upset and things like that. So if you do, you know that, oh, I've got people coming over that perhaps might upset them, you have to try and be skillful so that, you know, it doesn't happen. The other thing is, of course, you have them, people have them in the bedroom. So of course, you know, like this is the place where we sleep, and if you're in a relationship, well, it's the place we also have sex too. But again, this is not such a great idea to have these images of all enlightened beings looking down at us behaving quite unenlightenedly, very ordinarily, right? So again, just put it up. And you do not want to have it at the end of your bed, because that's exactly what your feet are all going to be sticking right out all night and every day. And this will seem to be less than respectful. And perhaps you need to move over to the side. And again, I've seen these, I often see them in the Chinese, in the movies, the Chinese, they're like.
Oh, like the little compartments. They're like a house. There's Indian have them as well. They've got drawers on them.
Yeah, that's right. I've got these three drawers, and you can just, you know, buy with the shops here. this poor mountain banger suddenly all the stuff was hidden away. And so we don't do that.
Because the Hindus have those special altars that have the compartment.
Okay, yeah. So even something like that, and you can, in fact, I guess what's about, you know, people just like ourselves, they put up like a cupboard on the wall, and it looks like, when you open it up, there's the whole altars right there. So what have we looked at so far? We looked at cleaning the room. Then we came to set up the altar and make the offerings. And then, of course, we sit down to do our practice. Now, when we come to sit down, we are not Tibetans or Indians who've had a lot of years and years of practice of sitting cross-legged. If we were, great, but we're not. So we could probably find this posture quite difficult. Now, the idea behind this posture, I mean, there's many, many ideas, but the major one for us is you just want the spine to be erect and to be comfortable. So comfort is of real importance here, because if you're not comfortable, you won't be able to meditate for very long. You get agitated and upset. The other thing about having the back very straight, the spine straight, is because there's many major energy channels or energies run up and down the spine. But if you ever, you can try this out yourself, is like sit on a chair and then slump. Just the other come like this and then go. And now suddenly there's this pressure on your tummy. So now the air can't get down there. It's all going to stay up here. If it's up there, you're going to be agitated and flighty. But you need to get it down here to slow everything down and get all your blood oxygenated. So you want to just sort of play around with this. These chairs that you're all sitting on, they're not good chairs for meditating on. You probably need to get like cushions. You want to sort of play around and try and use things to help you. Like, I often use these cushions, the blankets, anything, and try and make my seat a bit like this. Yeah. You can see here, I've got this thing underneath it, and then I've got my cushion. So then, whoops, there I'm flat. But if I put something like this down, and then the cushion, it'll give me this natural, I say, well, I don't have to try at all. And this is naturally. Another thing you might find you could do at home, if you're a bit strange, if you have a chair and it's not with the back sloping like this, it's just a nice straight back, is try and find a piece of 4x2 or another piece of timber and just put it beneath the back legs, like Demi's doing it. Tilts the chair up like that. So the seat is actually sloping down. And that again will give you just this natural straight back. You don't need to exert a lot of effort. So here is this posture is called the 7-point Virachana posture. And the person demonstrating is called Lama Yeshe, who is one of the founders of this center and many others around the world. So it begins by sitting your legs in the Vajra posture. So that's when your feet are your legs are crossed like that, but one foot rests on the thigh and the other on the other thigh. This is possible to do. You can find YouTube videos that will show you how to do this. But you've got to do it over time. Don't believe me, do not force yourself to do something like this. You need to do sort of strengthening or lengthening practices first before you can actually do the crossing and lift it up. So if you don't sit like that, sit like the way you're sitting. There's what they call a half. The Burmese posture, there's all sorts of different postures you can sit. But again, I said the most important thing is straight back, relaxed. So the hands, there are many different postures, different ways you can put the hands. Here it's like the left hand goes underneath, so the left arm is just about wisdom. You put everything is supported by wisdom. So you put the left under, then you put the method, loving kindness, bodhicitta, compassion. Rested on wisdom. Put your hands like that. Have the thumbs lightly touching. And you're just beneath your navel. You want a bit of space between here so air can come through. Otherwise, you get really hot. Now, the balls of the thumb is just lightly touching like that, so that when you, your eyes aren't, I mean, you'll see, but your eyes are like this, you need something to tell you whether you're still focused. So with your thumbs lightly touching, it helps. And you know, okay, yeah. And then when they fall apart, you're like, whoops, like, bring them back together again, I'm drifting off, right? My thumbs are fine. I just touch them back again, okay? Back in touch. Spine straight and relaxed. Head and neck slightly bent forward, the shoulders have got to be level. So what you'll often find in regards to the shoulders when you meditate, especially for people like us who have quite busy lives and a lot of tension and stress, you check your shoulders are quite like this. You sit there and all this tension comes in here because your shoulders are prepped up. So you need to sort of check. In fact, when you do this posture and sit and meditate, many times throughout the meditation, you should sort of just check, am I still relaxed? Are my shoulders down? Is my jaw relaxed? What are my eyes like? Jaw relaxed. Now, the face has over 40 different groups of muscles in it. And if you can relax your face, and you're way ahead of most people. So, you've got to check, that's right, just like that. Check your jaw and around your eyes especially. And so you can do, just I see somebody doing this is a good idea, you can do that. Other things I do is acupressure. Just go through the jaw and you find, oh my God, that's tight. And then so you just start rubbing it. Yeah, just like that. The eyes again, you know, it's a great idea if you cup your hands and just put them over your eyes. Gives me a bit of relief. When you're meditating, sometimes please smile. Right? Because it just naturally relaxes every muscle in your face. Even imagining you're smiling will do the same thing. Then I suggest that you put your tongue on the upper palate. Now, this is not so easy to do when you first start. The reason for doing it is once you get good at meditating, what can happen is you start to drool. So you just go, drip on your clothing, right? And perhaps you get embarrassed. It's like, oh my gosh. So to stop that, just put your tongue behind your upper teeth. Like that. Yeah. And your lips just lightly touch it. They're not closed, they're hard. Very light. And then, like I said, you just let your body breathe itself. Now the eyes. So again, there are many different positions for the eyes. In our tradition, the Galupas have a type of meditation called the Lam Rim, called graduated stages of a path to enlightenment. And that's what we mainly talk about here. When that type of meditation is done, which is primarily analytical, you're reflecting and thinking things through, they say so here's my eyes are closed, all right? I can't see any of you. I can't see anything, it's quite dark. But then if you just just open them very slightly, now I can see the book here, I can see the desk there. But because of what, you're fuzzy, and that's the posture for the eyes when you meditate on the graduated stages of the path to enlightenment. There are other ones where the eyes should be closed completely, others where it's like this, others where they're up like that. There's all sorts of different things that are going to produce different effects on you. And like I said here, the major one is just not completely closed, but just slightly open. But here is the 7-point Virachana posture. Sometimes the posture includes one extra point, the 8th point, and that is how to breathe. In this tradition I just talked about, the Lam Rim or graduated stages, the breathing is natural. Just let your breath naturally. Don't exert yourself or anything like this. You'll also find this not so easy. Because once you start paying attention to your breath, you find you're controlling it. So again, you just have to And take time, just try and relax a little more, relax a little more. And then the breath will breathe will come normally and naturally. Again, like against there are other types of meditation where the breath is different. You sort of control the breath. You would also maybe alter the way your eyes are, even though they're not like this. There are some meditations where your eyes are like that. So again, it's highly dependent. If you try and find the ones, read through the instructions or get good instructions when it comes to the posture. In fact, in the Zen tradition, the posture is everything. You get the posture right, everything just flows naturally after that. So I spend a lot of time on getting the seat correct for you. So now we've sat down. And of course, what we're going to do is sit down, and then it's going to be the motivation. Just like that started for us, right? We all sat down. I started with the motivation first, and then we sort of got into it. And after we've sat, we're going to relax ourselves a bit and think about, why am I here? What am I doing this for? And what's my purpose here? So you'll say all the necessary words, and you feel like, yes. Yes, that's why I'm here. I wish to become enlightened, to benefit all sentient beings. And the way to do this is the same way that every other person did it in the past. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to begin by taking the refuge. And so that leads us into this practice called refuge. So here, I've just written it up in Tibetan, because we don't usually do it here in Tibetan. We do it when we have visiting teachers, and we do it in the pujas and things like that. But for myself, I prefer to do it in English because everybody understands what it means. And if you're a newcomer and you start rattling off Tibetan, it's like, people just go, I don't know what they're talking about. And it's hard to join in there when you don't know what people are talking about. No, so anyway, I'll put it up here in the Tibetan because we don't often do it this way. But as you know, when we began, we said, I go for refuge. I was going to do a different one. But let's see what it says in the book here, how they do it. It's the most common one. I go for refuge, I'm slightly enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So that's what it's getting at. And we say this like three times. Yes. Now, what's our time? 36? Good. I'm way ahead of myself. Often, I'm way behind. So, any questions about this little section? Now, I'm just touching on these points, right? And we do other whole modules. There's a whole module just on refuge. There's another whole module we're doing on the sitting and all this sort of thing. So each of these can be quite elaborate and depth. If you get the general idea of what we're trying to do, that's what I'm trying to impart to you. But again, something jumps up into your mind, and you think, yeah, but what about this or what about that? Then please, say something. Okay, so let's do our first meditation then on what we've done. So again, if you're sort of reasonably new here, or even if you are been here for quite a while, remember meditation is the process of becoming familiar with something. So I'll just introduce you to coming, cleaning the room, cleaning the altar, putting the offerings on the altar, sitting down. Through the motivation, now I take refuge. So this is what I'd like to become familiar with. And like I said, whether we just sit around the kitchen table and go, so what was the first thing? I walked in, and I got up from my clothes. Yeah, I could do that. Then I had something to drink. Yeah, I know what to do there. But then I went to do my meditation. So I know I've cleaned the room. Dust out, dirt out, dust out. Okay. So it's nice and clean. I go to the altar, I clean the altar, and I set up the offerings. Now, what was on the altar? What's in the middle? There's a Buddha there. on the left-hand side, the arm that was down, that's where the text is. On the other side is a thing called stupa. In front of them is like different rows of offerings. And behind the Buddha, but up there is a picture of the guru. So then I sat down, that was right there, and I said, why am I doing this? I'm motivation. And then I took refuge. And I said, there you go. Now, okay, I began with taking refuge. What did I do before I took refuge? I set my motivation. What did I do before I set my motivation? I sat down. What did I do before I sat down? Trying to prepare the offering, the main offerings. What did I do before that? I cleaned the area. What did I do before that? I had a cup of tea, I offered it to the Buddhists, the Bodhisattvas, blah, 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 blah. And what happened then? Well, I got changed, I put some clothes on, and that was to remind me to be patient. So that's, you know, that's what you're sort of doing. And what makes it even easier for you, of course, is when you actually do it. That's from second nature to your own. You say, yeah, I get up in the morning, I do this and that, and I clean the place, I set it up, I sit down, set my motivation, I take refuge. Now, so it's different from person to person. So there's no like hard rules here. So in fact, it's probably very good to do like yoga or stretching or something even more physical beforehand, because it's just wonderful how it charges you up to sit down to meditate. Now, exercise really clears things up for you. Yes, there are a number of different texts you could put on the altar. So sometimes you put the text that you're actually studying, you put that on the altar. Depending upon how large your altar is, of course. So if they're large enough, you could put a number of different texts on it. Or if it's quite small, like I've got one altar that's quite small, so my text is about that long. It's just this whole sutra, really condensed down and wrapped up and made nice, so it just suits the right size. But then another one I've got is all the lamb ribbon, that's really large, but there's still a way you can put it up. You know? It just, so what suits you? Many times they say, put up the Heart Sutra or the Diamond Cutter Sutra on the altar, because, or any Prajnaparamita text, because that's, if you can realize that, you're liberated. That's those texts about wisdom are often suggested you put up there.
When my kids were really young, I had to flip the routine around and do all my water bowl offerings at nighttime because morning was too hard when they were little babies. So.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
See?
So these gold purple has the Heart Sutra in it.
Yeah, this is it. Yeah. Yes, if you had something like that, it's got a lot of material in it. So, yeah, so the text you're studying, you could have that primarily up there. Well, thanks for asking. Well, bad. Yeah. Okay, so now remember, so we come up to here, now we've taken refuge. Okay. Now we come to the suggestions of Lama Zopa Rinpoche about how he'd like his students to begin the day. Okay. So you'll see in that little, in that little text, it starts off where you take refuge, and then you either do the speech blessing, or you recite that short Lam Rim text, right? And then you do a few thought transformation practice. And these are all part of the motivation. That's the motivation being set up again, you know. So depend upon how you want to do it. All these practices are quite fluid. They're always designed to suit the individual. So there's no sort of thing of like, you know, this is how you do it. Okay. In some practices where it's much more structured and everybody's working together, then they would say, okay, this is how we're going to do it. We're all going to do it this way. But if you're at home practicing on your own, oh, it's a little different. You work a way to do it. Okay, so now remember, so okay, we've taken refuge, we've generated the mind of enlightenment. And this is like, you know, this is what we did when we started here. Right? Set the motivation, take refuge, generate a mind of enlightenment, and then you do a few other things. So here, here, I'll tell you about shortly. First, let's do the meditation on this material that we've just done, and then I'll introduce you to the next topic. So, okay, just get comfortable in your seat, everybody. Again, just make sure the back is straight, shoulders relaxed. In fact, if you want to stand up for a little bit, or just change your posture, like you go like this here, like that. Yeah, so, you know, just please stand up, just move about a bit, stretch like this. Do something. We've been all sitting down quite still for quite some time. Okay, you're all sitting comfortably on the seat. Your shoulders relax and your back is straight. And your hands are placed where they feel most comfortable. So I want you to imagine that you're walking into your meditation space. And you begin to dust and to clean that space. What are you saying mentally? And when you begin to dust the altar and its objects, how is that altar set out? You just try and see it in your mind, and maybe say, Buddha's in the center. Over here is this, there's that, and so forth. So take a little time. How's the altar set out? What's it look like? You often make three frustrations, and you can say different things to increase the merit of each frustration. Like Namo Manjushriya, Namo Sushriya, Namo Uttama Shriya Saha. Then you come to sit on the cushion. So check your posture while you're sitting on the cushion. You first check your legs that they're comfortable. Now, how are your hands placed? And what about your spine and your shoulders and your head? And where is the tongue placed? And where is the gaze of the eyes focused? And of this posture, what is of critical importance? What's most important? Is that your spine is straight and that you're relaxed? So try that now. If you just lift your the spine so it is straight, your shoulders are relaxed, energy flows. You can place a smile on your face. I'm sitting comfortably, taking refuge. You're going to take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. The question is, why are you doing that? So again, you affirm that you wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings. And this is why you're meditating and taking refuge. And if you know the refuge formula, you can recite it under your breath. And these formulas are written in many different ways. And once you've recited the formula for taking refuge, allow yourself to feel a sense of safety and direction. Now, in your own time, see if you can run that backwards. Think of, okay, here I am, I've taken refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. What did I do before that? And before that, I'm just trying to go backwards until you find yourself walking into the meditation space to clean it. Okay, when you've entered that space now, just allow your eyes to open. And the next is exhale. Just exhale as much air out of the can so you completely relax once again. Okay. So we've taken refuge, and then we've set our motivation, taken refuge, and then we're now going to begin some form of practice. And here, the form of practice that Lama Zopa Rinpoche has encouraged us and advised us to do is to bless our speech. So you might wonder, this word bless, what the heck does that mean? It just means that that your mind changes from one state to another state about your speech in this case. Now, for most of us, I'm pretty sure we don't, we can, we are not likely to go around hitting people or killing them or killing animals and insects. We probably find we could restrain ourselves there. And we're not likely to take things that don't belong to us. Nor are we likely to engage in sexual misbehavior, getting involved with other people's partners and so forth. We have one of our own. I think most of us could go, no, I'm not going to do any of that. And I don't. Simple. But when it comes to speech, that's another story. It's very difficult to control the speech. And so this practice is about just that, purifying the speech so that it doesn't hinder our own spiritual progress and it doesn't hurt others. And this is practice is about how we do that. And as you know, it always begins by doing an emptiness meditation. You can arise as the deity or with a body of light. Then on your tongue, as this little syllable arises, it transforms into a moon disc. And on that moon disc is another syllable for om, and so forth. And then you have around it the white vowels, the red consonants, and this mantra of dependent arising, which is colored blue. So you're sitting next to you, right? You're not as an ordinary human being. You're sitting there and going, like, whatever your favorite deity is, that's what you are. You're sitting there. So now you're imagining yourself as a completely enlightened being. And on, like I said, on your tongue is these things here. And then the light beams go out from each of the mantra vowels. They draw back all the power of the enlightened speech, all powers of beings on the path and so forth. So you get a great deal of power in the speech. And then you recite these mantras that go along with it. And finally, everything absorbs and you sort of come back out of it and then you'll do the practice. So let's do that. So this is one way of actually doing these practices. We've taken refuge, now we can begin the practice. So let's do that. We've talked about the emptiness meditation before. You need to know, first of all, what is it that's not there? What's important to be negated? Negate it, know that it's not there, and then do it again and again. Like meditate, become familiar with what you're doing. So we've got about 7 minutes, so I think we'll do a proper squeeze in. We at least do this part, which is the most important part. So please, again, we're going to do another meditation. You just get comfortable in the seat. Okay, so each of you is sitting on a seat. Is your body also on that seat? You say, yes, it is. Are you naturally established to be one and the same as your body? In other words, you are the body. The body is you. You are the body. Are you that? Your answer is, no, I'm not. But why? Why are you not one and the same as the body? He said, why? Because my identity, my sense of self and I is just a name given to the body. I is imputed to the body. So you are not the body. Your sense of identity is imputed to the body, and that's why. So now I want you to imagine that you've just got up from that seat, walk 3 or 4 paces, and turned around and looked back at the seat. The question is, what is on the seat? Your answer is, I do not see anything on the seat. There is no body on the seat. Which means the body has no intrinsic identity. Now that not there, that absence that you can recognize, that takes the form of your favorite deity. Your wisdom that sees there's no intrinsic body there, it takes the form of a wisdom body, a body of light. And you impute yourself to that. And then you say, I am the deity. And my tongue sort of white up. It transforms into a white moon seed. On that white moon seed is a silver om. It's surrounded by a mantra garland of white syllables. And around it is another mantra garland of red syllables. These are the consonants, the other, the white with the vowels, the red are the consonants. Now around it is another blue circle of figures. This is a mantra of dependent arising. From these three garlands of letters and light, light rays fill the 10 directions of space. They draw back all the powers of the speech of the enlightened beings. And this power appears like the syllables, red syllables, white syllables, blue, so just raining down through space. And it rains down onto these mantras, which absorb it. Now when the imagine there's a rain of white light coming down, being soaked into the white mantra garland on your tongue. And you hear and say, om, ah, ee, ooh, ooh. Really, really, ee, ee, ah, ah, so ha. Oh, ah, ah, ee, ee, really, really, ee, ah, ah, so ha. Oh, ah, ah, ee, ee, really, really, ee, ah, ah, so ha. That every non-virtuous act that you've ever done with your body is completely purified. Does not exist as an emptiness. And you say, oh, kaka gagana, sasa sagana, tata gagana, tata gagana, baba baba ma, yara ma, shaka saha, ke so ha. Oh, kaka gagana, sasa sagana, tata gagana, tata gagana, baba baba ma, yara ma, shaka saha, ke so ha. The red lights of nectar flow through you, purifying all negative karmas from this life and all past lives that have to do with speech. The speech is completely purified. Then you say, Om Yerdama Heti Prabhama Heti Takuntata Gara Yavana Tekan Sayo Niroda Iva Mari Mahashamana Yasoha. So there's a blue light rain falling down Amidama hetu prabhava hetu tadagara yavata taken sayam niranda nirambari mahashramana yasoha. Amidama hetu prabhava hetu taken tadagara yavata taken sayam niranda nirambari mahashramana yasoha. The blue lights and nectars from the harsh mantra of dependent origination are flowing through you, purifying all negative karmas from this life and all past lives. Every negative action accumulated as one's mind has been completely purified and does not exist within the sphere of emptiness. And now this blue mantra of dependent origination is absorbed into the red consonants. The red consonants are now absorbed into the white vowels. The white vowels are now absorbed into the silver om. And the om is absorbed into the moon cushion. In the moon cushion, it's transformed into a pink type of nectar. And this is absorbed into your tongue. And the tongue becomes very strong and firm, feels. It's difficult to move. I think that this is because all the blessings and strength and power of every enlightened being has been absorbed into your tongue. And you think my speech has become perfect. And then to complete the practice, you say, may my tongue, sense space, have all the courage of the ones called to bliss. By the magnificence and power of my words, may all sentient beings be subdued. May all the meanings of whatever words I say be accomplished. And that will bring you to the end of the practice. So what's your takeaway for today? You should know what like Dharma and what meditations are. Like meditation, again, just becoming familiar with what we're doing. That's what meditation is. Dharma is just the means to hold you back from suffering. So we need to become familiar with those methods that hold us back from suffering. See if you can apply the Dharma. Some of you weren't here for these other things, but you could apply it now for clothing and drinking. Clothing yourself and drinking. And next week, we'll go through the rest of these practices of the six preliminaries. And next week's mainly focused on a practice called the seven limbs. And please, when you do have the text, keep trying to practice and make it great for yourself that you actually feel good doing this thing. Like I said, it doesn't take long. I think that was less than 10 minutes, what we just did. It's a very quick meditation you can do. So, of course, brings us back to the end of our class. So, you know, whenever we meditate, there are two things of vital importance. The first is the motivation. And the second one is this. It's called when you finish the practice, we've exerted some energy in what we're doing. So we want to take it and direct it to what we want it to go for. So we want it to become a means for us to become enlightened and all beings to become enlightened. So we dedicate what we've done. So please join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, now I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha, and lead all living beings, without exception, into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise in life. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. The wish granted, wish fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind kids and guts, I have the siege. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, the prayer for the discovery of Rinpoche's reincarnation and swift return. In holding and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that's never discouraged. incomparable, venerable guru, you are necklace.